Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Louder Than Silence podcast. My name is Lori Poland, and I am here with Brad Watts. Brad was on our show last season, and Brad's podcast is one of our top downloaded podcasts. And we talked with Brad about sibling sexual abuse, and I'm not sure because our podcast accessibility is really on so many different platforms, and we don't necessarily know the people that are downloading them, but I'm not sure, what prompts people to click, but I think just common sense tells me that there's people that want to know about it. People want to hear about it and understand it. Maybe they relate, maybe they're curious. And that prompted us to have Brad back on. At the end of our podcast last time, we talked about, hey, you want to come back? And he said, yes. So, Brad, it's such a pleasure to have you.
Oh, it's great to be back, Lori. Thank you so much for having me on.
Absolutely. It's truly a pleasure. I mean, honestly, Brad, I've spoken of you, your work, your book, I mean, umpteen times since we met last year in various different meetings and just different conversations. And one of them was specifically, I remember when you shared the success rate of juveniles that went through the prevention program and the treatment program that you worked in. And I think it was something like, please correct me if I'm wrong, something like between 97 and 98% success rate of non-recurring abuse.
Right.
Is that accurate?
Yeah. And that's just the research with juvenile people that commit sexual harm, that act out sexually. So it's incredibly high, but if we can get them to treatment. So it's obviously like what you've experienced, very hopeful and very positive. But I think a lot of people don't realize.
Yeah. I mean, almost like this could be a truly preventable issue. Right. And to be able to say, all right, if we saw these red flags and ideally caught those red flags before abuse actually occurred, we could provide support, provide treatment, do some intervention, and then really see some significant change. Is that accurate?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's the problem. It's just identifying it. And with sibling sexual abuse, as we talked about, as I talk about in my book, the real problem is that we don't talk about it. Yeah. It's one of the last real taboos in our public discourse, in a discourse that we're able to talk about most anything. And that's really what I'm trying to do, is to try and talk to people about, let's talk about it, because you're right, then we can catch those red flags, hopefully, before it happens.
Yeah. So, Brad, let's start with, first of all, what's the name of your book?
Sibling Sexual Abuse, A Guide to America's Silent Epidemic.
Excellent. And where can people get it? Is it on Audible? Is it on Amazon, Kindle? Tell us where it's.
It's on Amazon. You can also go to my website, bradwattslpc.com, and that'll link you right there to it. But it's up
Excellent.
On Amazon.
So I'll just reiterate that, bradwattslpc.com. And hopefully we can put those in the show notes, but I'm not the producer, but I'm pretty positive our producer is magical. So we'll try and put those in the show notes for y'all so that you can have access to those. But, and then I would love, Brad, just kind of stay on the topic of red flags. What do some of those red flags look like so that our audience members who are listening can, just keep their eyes open?
Yeah. So a lot of it, when you talk about causes, it has to do with maltreatment, neglect, are big things, prior sexual abuse, prior physical abuse, those kinds of things that we can look at. So as far as things to notice when we're starting to trend that way, so it can be poor sexual boundaries, involvement, particularly in violent kinds of pornography, it certainly can be a real trigger as far as leading in with that, particularly to those who have these predisposed risk factors. So Ybarra, I think it's in 2011, led a study talking about those who sought out sexually explicit material that had those risk factors had a 6 times more likely to commit sexually violent acts than those who don't. And again, that tie in with pornography, that violent pornography tied in with those risk factors. So we're not saying everybody that looks at porn is going to go out and sexually abuse, but those have a much higher risk factor with those predisposed, situations that can increase the risk.
Sure. And can you give our listeners an idea of what some of those risk factors look like?
Yeah. So you're looking at, you know, a lot of it has to do with their own kinds of abuse, conflict in the home, domestic violence is a huge one, whether it's just witnessing that kind of behavior in the home. And then you're looking at, again, poor sexual boundaries, sexualized behaviors, those kinds of things, particularly at a younger age.
Okay. And then, obviously our hope, your hope, my hope, and I think I know NCAN's hope is to give people hope, right?
Right.
To give people possibility and hope that there are multiple options. And as a sexual abuse survivor myself, I think it one of my biggest fears as a small child, and I don't know where I heard it or who I heard it from. I genuinely have no memory of that piece, but I do know that early on, I had to have been maybe between 9 and 11. Mm-hmm. I had heard somewhere that because I was a sexual abuse survivor, I would likely grow up and become a perpetrator. And that I never told anybody. I think this is maybe the second or third time I've even said these words out loud. But
yeah.
I remember the fear of, oh my gosh, I don't want to be like that. What do I have to do? And then the pressure to not be like that and not tell anybody was so high for me. And I'm just one of hundreds of millions of people,
Yeah.
Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, and that's really a big misnomer. And I've talked to other survivors that have shared similar experiences to yours, Lori, thinking this incredible pressure, like, holy cow, I don't want to tell anybody because they're going to think I'm going to go and sexually offend on somebody. And the reality is it's a really low number, comparatively what we would think, of those that have experienced their own sexual abuse that have turned around and offended. One study I read, and I can't remember off the top of my head, but it was about 23%, which is incredibly a lot less than what we would think. I experienced or was a part of a training a year ago or so where Matthew Sandusky, the foster child of Jerry Sandusky, the famed, infamous Penn State defensive coordinator who sexually abused all those children for years and years. Somebody on that training asked him, they said, Matthew, do you ever have a real problem, a real urge to sexually offend on others? And he's like, no, I've never had that thought. And he likened it to if someone came up and punched him in the face or any of us in the face, would we then turn around and punch some other stranger in the face? It's like, no, we wouldn't do that. So, and he was speaking just for his experience, but I think we lump in too many survivors and in essence, what we're stifling, what we can learn from them, because a lot of people are afraid to say, because, hey, are you going to think I'm going to turn around and sexually offend? So I don't want to tell anybody.
Well, yeah. And that really leads me to wanting to talk with you about like power of silence, right? And in your title, right? The title of your book, you have the word silence. And don't you? Isn't it?
I do. Yeah.
Silent epidemic. Yeah, yeah. Okay. I'm like, wait, did I get that wrong? And so the power of silence, and one of NCAN's kind of big campaigns is being louder than silence. And that can be a whisper, that can be a written word, that can be a scream, it can be anything but just being louder than silence, because the pendulum of speaking, the pendulum of doing anything but keeping that secret can create so much change for you, for your community, for everybody. And yet that also can have this ripple effect, right? Especially with sibling sexual abuse, which is really common. I don't know what the numbers are. I'd love to hear if you do, but it is really common. And so the impact that sibling sexual abuse can have on a family system, I would imagine can perpetuate silence. So talk to us about that, you know, the pros of speaking out and then obviously people's fears of speaking out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, you think about a child. So the average, you know, the average survivor is somewhere between 6 and 9 years old. Mm-hmm. So think about that. The average sibling that's committed sexual harm is about 15. And so you think mm-hmm. about brain development and then what's being said to that person to keep mm-hmm. them quiet. Again, you should be able to trust your older brother or sister implicitly. You grow mm-hmm. up and you're like, hey, what my brother's telling me this, I'm going to believe him. He's my protector. And so you think about all those layers that mm-hmm. they have to go through in disclosing. And then there's the threat of physical harm, further abuse, withdrawal of love from the family.
Breaking the family up.
Exactly. Aren't mm-hmm. going to believe them. Yeah, that mm-hmm. I'm going to be the reason that the family breaks up. I'm afraid that, hey, even if they do believe me, that I'm not going to see my brother again.
Yeah.
So it's like all those layers make mm-hmm. it so, so hard for them. And then in a lot of cases, it's this, we keep it in the family because of the stigma mm-hmm. that's involved with sibling sexual abuse. What is it saying about our family? As parents function. Mm-hmm. And so just the fear and keeping that in-house. And so a lot of it goes to the fact that we're not talking about it. And so mm-hmm. parents and survivors don't feel safe to disclose. And parents want to keep it in
hush,
essence,
hush.
Hush, hush. Mm-hmm. You know, in so many cases where they find out, they know, and then it's a response such as, we can't tell anybody, we keep this between us.
Or it's minimized.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. There's the feeling of, well, you're complicit in this. You know, you have responsibilities as the survivor, which is one of the worst things that we can do. And there's a lot of victim shaming in traditional ways that we've seen for years and years on these kids. And it's just incredible. The trauma just goes on and on, you know, these kinds of things.
And so what would you, if when somebody comes into your office and you're hearing all of those layers, you're hearing the fear of talking about it, you're hearing the shock for the parents, you're hearing maybe minimization or denial, you're hearing justification, you're hearing confusion, you know, all of those things. What do you do? What do you say to people?
Well, you have to unpack a lot. And so there's a lot of times different conversations with parents and what you have with kids. And so parents often are, depending at what point, you know, they're at in the severity, devastated and feeling like that their family can't be put back together, that there is no hope, all the trauma that they've been through. And so it's really trying to help them see that, yes, this is a long, hard road, but there is a path forward. And these are and like what we talked about at the beginning, there's a lot of evidence in the literature and clinical practice and anyone that works in this field with juveniles who act out sexually, there's a lot of hope for them to turn things around. But again, it's so important that we get kids and families, not because it's a family problem, into treatment. So we just can't say, hey, this kid that's committed sexual harm, he's going to receive treatment. Nobody else will receive treatment. Everybody needs to be in treatment. And again, it's a family problem and it needs to be addressed within the family dynamic.
Well, and, you know, just to take it globally, but I'm going to bring it right back to this topic. I think that's the case in any trauma on a child, right? The impact of trauma on a family system it's undeniable. No matter if the abuser is inside the family or outside the family or, you know, as a cultural trauma or whatever, the impact on the whole family system is undeniable. And if we can all look at it like it's a systemic thing that needs to be attended to, then healing happens around the survivor as opposed to just at the survivor, right? So bringing it back, One of the thoughts that came to mind was one thing I've heard a lot in my career about this field is that only happens to people in those neighborhoods. That only happens to at risk. And nobody can see me, but I'm using my fingers in the infamous air quotes. It only happens to at risk people, and you talk about risk factors, you talk about red flags, but I'm just curious if this happens to a specific demographic of people. Is it, you know, just East Coasters or just Southerners? tell me if you might not know that answer, and that's okay if you don't. I am curious though.
Yeah. One of the things with this, Lori, is, and this is what I learned early on and really, really impressed me. I won't say impressed, but disturbed me, I guess, was the fact that it affects, it knows no culture, it knows no race, it knows no economic, whatever, income level. You go back to Adler and Schultz wrote an article about this, did some research back in 1995, and it was all these kids in affluent white households. And I've seen it cut across every race that you can. And, I've talked to people since I wrote the book, and many people have said, hey, Brad, you know, you mistitled that thing. It should be the world's silent epidemic. And that's true. This is a worldwide problem. And it isn't just an American problem or a problem in the UK. It cuts across. It's our problem throughout the world. And so it affects all kinds of families. It affects high functioning. It affects dysfunctional families. I've seen incredible families, and they've just been like, you know, how did this happen? And also families that have a lot of disorganization and a lot of problems in it as well.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I think, you know, that's one thing I really have been noticing lately, that, you know, when something is uncomfortable, we want to find any way we can to differentiate ourselves from it. And so I think that perpetuates and feeds that silence, right? I don't want to be like that. And so therefore, if I do it this way, then I'm not that. And I think we see that across the board, that this isn't a fringe problem. This isn't just something that happens, like you said, on the outside to maybe people in poverty or people of different cultures or people in different countries. This is an all of us issue. So thank you for validating that. Then my next question, I'm sorry, I'm just like firing questions at you. We're going to have you back, Brad. It's just going to have to happen. But my next question is, if you know anything about age of disclosure, you know, as a therapist myself, I've had a number of families who later in life, you know, moms and dads who are, you know, up in their 70s or even older, come in and speak to me about their children disclosing to them that when they were children, that a sibling abused them. And then, you know, the ripple effect, it's like that immediate response is so observed and scrutinized, which for all of us, immediate responses, unfortunately, don't oftentimes happen the way that we best intend them to, especially when we're in the midst of shock, right? Like it's almost like a death or grief. And so, you know, there's an expectation of having a specific type of response and of that maybe parent to cut off the offender or to turn the offender in or what have you. I'm just curious, you speak a lot of adolescents and there's this great success rate. And, you know, the reality is that there are, I would guess, more people than not who are still living this silently and who even still have never disclosed or shared. And have any understanding of that later on disclosure piece?
So there's some research that says that the delay in disclosure is somewhere between 3 and 18 years. So okay. Just kind of do the math on that. Yeah, so you see a lot of cases and you know, I've learned this from just survivors contacting me, a lot of them sharing their stories, is we see a lot of them disclosing in their 40s, you know, when they're much older, and they get to a point where they see the only way out from this crushing burden that they've been carrying for all these years is disclosure, and they don't feel safe enough in a lot of cases to do it until adulthood. And they still receive all kinds of pressure, all kinds of threats and pressures from the family. You still see a lot of cases where parents simply won't believe them. And so there's all these factors, but a lot of them have reported and do report that this freeing feeling once it's disclosed as an adult. But like what you're saying, Lori, there's probably a majority thinking some of the research that I've read will never disclose sibling sexual abuse, that they'll just always, you know, keep that. And we do know those coming into therapy, there's some research, great research out of the UK. And one of their findings found that when these adults come to therapy, they're coming not necessarily to talk about sibling sexual abuse. They're talking about problems with relationships, anger, depression, substance use. But so they'll be with a therapist on average 18 months before they'll disclose that they've been sexually abused by a sibling.
Yeah. Well, and that is not surprising. As a clinician, that doesn't surprise me in any way. Because I think what oftentimes happens is two things. One, when we have trauma, especially ongoing trauma, we oftentimes survive through dissociating, which for our listeners is essentially a very lay term of it, or juvenile, or I guess lay description of it is like we almost forget. We just kind of numb out and just go through almost in a zombie type state where we don't have any real memory of things. And then when we do have memory, we question it because there's confusion around it because it's all kind of foggy. So there's that. And then the other piece to that with the disclosure is that we don't realize the impacts of things in our childhood and how those things influence our adulthood. I mean, I can't even tell you how much victim shaming comes from that place, right? But substance abuse, heart disease, diabetes, cancer, mental illness, relationship problems, parenting issues, all of that stuff, career issues, self-esteem, all of it is so intertwined. And until you start untying the knot of yarn, all of a sudden, in the middle of the knot, you see, oh, well, wait a minute, there's this. And the way that we survive is through finding ways to just kind of adapt, which is magical that humans can do that. It's really magical and can cause a lot of harm to us. So that isn't surprising at all. I am curious, you mentioned that since you were on last time, Brad, you had said, you know, that you have something that's even better than your book. And you're like, I like it even more than my book. And I want all of our audience to hear that. And what is that?
Yeah, so I've created a 3-hour, sometimes longer, sometimes shorter, training on sibling sexual abuse that I've been taking different states throughout the country, and I've really enjoyed that. And as far as just having these discussions with people on training how to, you know, recognize, respond to sibling sexual abuse, looks at treatment, looks at really kind of every aspect of it. And so it's really been enjoyable to get to meet, you know, and interact with lots of different groups. So just trying to get it in front of as many people as I can to have these discussions. Yeah. So it's really for everybody.
How do people find you?
Yeah, feel free to contact me on my website, bradwattslpc.com. My email is just bradwattslpc@gmail.com. And I love hearing from people. And like I said, feel free to reach out to me and would love to talk to you.
Excellent. And then one more time before we go today, first of all, everybody, we will do our very best to keep Brad as a regular on our podcast, because it's clear that you have a depth of information, and I'm grateful that you're willing to share with us and our audience. But secondly, one more time, tell people what the name of your book is, what the name of your training is, and where they can find you. You just did, but we'll do it again.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. The name of the book, Sibling Sexual Abuse, A Guide to Confronting America's Silent Epidemic. The training I've amended that title, but it's similar. Sibling Sexual Abuse, A Guide to Confronting the World's Silent Epidemic. And then my website is bradwattslpc.com. And my email again is bradwattslpc@gmail.com.
Excellent. Brad, thank you so much. I can't believe that the time went so fast today, but I am eternally grateful just to be able to have this discussion with you. Thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule again to meet with us. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Lori Poland. I am with the Louder Than Silence podcast. Thank you all again for being here with us, for listening, for downloading. Please be sure to like our podcast so that we can continue to amplify and spread the word. And this is, again, such a wonderful opportunity. Thanks again, Brad.
Thanks, Lori. I appreciate it.
Yeah, have a great day.